You're listening to Critical Reads. This show is designed to help people critically analyze topics like race, culture, and faith, one resource at a time. I am your host, Neff Lesperance. Hi, everyone, and welcome to another exciting episode of Critical Reads, the podcast. As the intro says, I am your host, Neff. I'm excited to be doing another episode for you all. This one is going to be a bonus episode because I know the past few weeks I haven't posted that many, but for the end of Black History Month, I was like, hey, let's hit them with a twofer. So that's what I'm doing. So today, for this bonus episode, I did want to talk about a resource that I kind of talked about in the last episode that I did with The Cross and the Lynching Tree. It's a book that's entitled Without Sanctuary. And this book was put together by an author named James Allen. And it also has essays by a few people, including Hilton Owls, John Lewis, and Leon Litwack. So I'm really excited to share this book with you guys. One thing that's really interesting about this book is it's mostly a book on that has a lot of photography in it. It's not a lot of reading. I know the first few pages of the book, you will get like a foreword from John Lewis, who recently passed away. And then it has some stories by some other people as well that I will talk about a little bit in a bit. But I did find this resource to be something that was very challenging to look at, but also thought-provoking and important. And just like we talked about in the previous episode where I did The Cross and the Lynching Tree, it is so important for us to not run away and shy away from looking at these images or looking at resources like this book and really talk about the horribleness of our history if we want to move forward and grow and just become a better society. And like I said in the last episode as well, that is something that is very similar in that what happened with the Germans and the Holocaust and all that stuff, like they had to take a minute and look at their history and say, oh my gosh, we really messed up here. And they had to figure out reparations and they had to really make amends to some degree of like what they've done. And even till this day, we still talk about it. We still read books about it. And we're still, you know, having this sense of never forget, right? So in the same way, I think this is what all the photos and all the stuff in this book is trying to invite us to do. And part of why I wanted to share this book on this podcast and use it as one of the resources that I talk about on this podcast is because, unfortunately, I don't think enough of us even know about this book or know that this book exists. I know the only reason I'm familiar with this book is because of The Cross and the Lynching Tree and the fact that Cohen brought it up. But outside of that, I had no idea that it existed. So again, I hope that as I talk about it today, hopefully it will encourage a lot more of us to be willing to grapple with the book and grapple with what's in the book and even purchase it and try to learn from it and teach our kids what's in it so that, again, we're not repeating the same things, even though I would almost argue that we are, but in the forms of police brutality and other stuff. But before we really dive into this book, I wanted to begin this episode again like I normally do by taking some time to do my segment that I entitle Musings of a Tired Black Social Worker. And like I say, this is a time where I just kind of reflect on something interesting or something that caught my attention during the week you know, I just bring it to you all here so we can talk about it, deconstruct. You can get a chance to see a little bit of how I think through things that I see on the internet or I see in my personal life. And that really forced me to like be like, whoa, what are we saying here? What are we doing here, right? And so for today's topic, I wanted to talk about a quote that I saw on Instagram that was posted by this person with the handle at Wear the Peace, which is Wear as in W-E-A-R, the peace. And so what they posted was this quote that says, Racism isn't a touchy subject if you're not a racist. And so I will say right off the bat, when I saw that, I was like, damn, like, whoever posted this thing is trying to be spicy, trying to go for the jugular. They did not come to play today. All of this stuff. And of course, you know, I liked it. I reposted it. I was like, damn, this person says something, right? And I think over time, as I was like just reflecting on this post, I felt like it would be cool to kind of bring it onto this podcast and also add some nuance to it, right? Because I think a lot of the time when you say stuff like this, the reaction is to quickly be like, oh, well, I'm not a racist. I just, you know, I don't want to talk, like, you know, to be defensive, right? And so I think that's why for me, I was like, you know what? Let me see if I can add some nuance to this conversation so that if somebody does read this comment or even if they hear me talk about this on the podcast, they can maybe have some thought-provoking conversations or have something else to chew on as they're thinking about this post, right? And so I think one of the things that I think is important to just define is the word racism, because I think a lot of the times, like, I even hear Black people say, like, oh, like, I'm being racist towards somebody. And although I do think we all kind of struggle with racism, whether it's internalized or, like, full-blown racism, I guess, like, it happens. But I do think, like, a lot of the times we have to be reminded that racism, yes, it's like you have prejudice, but also it's prejudice with power, you know? So I think, like, as a Black person, I always like to be reminded, like, with me, for example, I can be prejudiced, I could be biased, which everybody has, but I personally don't think that as a Black person, I really have the power to be racist, because I don't really have the power to have institutionalized oppression over somebody. And I think that's why a lot of the times when we challenge white people, especially about racism, it's not the fact that you have your bias and your prejudice, because I think everybody has that, but it's the fact that you can use your prejudice and your bias to also have power over people. And so we see that with, like, you know, the way the government runs sometimes, and, you know, like, how there's a system in place to keep certain people down based off of their race. So that's what I often think it's important for us to kind of really talk about, because I don't think that, you know, we're really doing a good job of really explaining what racism really looks like. But I will say all of us do, again, struggle with being biased and prejudiced. Like, we all, even with me, like, I have bias towards social workers because I'm a social worker. I have a bias towards listening to Black women or women of color because I happen to identify as that, right? So we do, all of us do have our own biases and prejudices that we have to check, right? So on top of that, I do think when we talk about racism, it's important to recognize that there's different forms of racism. So I will post an article about this, obviously, for you guys in the notes as a resource, but the National Museum of African American History and Culture does a really good job of describing the different types of racism. And so they point out that there's individual, interpersonal, institutional, and structural, right? And so with individual racism, this kind of refers to beliefs and attitudes and actions of individuals that support or perpetuate racism in a conscious or unconscious ways. The U.S. cultural narrative about racism typically focuses on individual racism, but fails to recognize systemic racism, which is something that we'll talk about, obviously. And so an example of this, they say, can include, like, believing in the superiority of white people and, like, not hiring a person of color because something doesn't feel right, or even telling a racist joke. And I know with this, a lot of the times you'll hear stupid shit like, oh yeah, but we could hire a Black person, but we don't know if they're going to be qualified. You know, qualified is another way that they say that. And maybe that could even fall under institutional for all we know, but that's individual, right? Interpersonal racism occurs between individuals. These are public expressions of racism that kind of involve like slurs, biases, hateful words, or actions. So obviously, you know, for Black people, being called the N-word, lynching, which is what we've talked about a lot. We've seen lately with, for example, with the Asian community, there's a lot of very anti-Asian speech that's been happening, especially us calling coronavirus the Chinese virus, which is horrible. There's been a lot of like killings and stuff that's also been associated with that community right now because of the anti-Asian stuff that's been going on. So those are some examples of interpersonal racism. And with institutional racism, this occurs in an organization. These are discriminatory treatments, unfair policies, or biased practices based on race that result in inequitable outcomes for whites over people of color and extend considerably beyond prejudice. These institutional policies often never mention any racial group, but the intent is to create, you know, advantages, right? So, for example, a school system where students of color are more frequently distributed into the most crowded classrooms and underfunded schools and out of higher resourced schools. So that's a really big example, because I know oftentimes because of this system of how we school children, there's this whole thing of like the school to prison pipeline, you know, where basically we're seeing that a lot of children and youth are kind of being deprived of like meaningful opportunities towards education, future employment, and participation in our democracy. And instead, they're being pushed into the streets and eventually they're arrested and all that stuff. And eventually becoming repeating offenders. And obviously I will put some information about that in the show notes so you guys can do more research. But that's just one example of where we see some institutional racism kind of happening, right? And then the last one is structural racism, where this is basically the overarching system of racial bias across institutions and society. These systems give privileges to white people, resulting in disadvantages to people of color. And so an example of this is like stereotypes of people of color as criminals in mainstream movies and media. And even if we want to say, nah, this doesn't happen, I will say as an immigrant, most of the movies and all these things that Haitians, for example, see of Black Americans end up being of Black Americans being in gangs and shooting and all these different things. So when Haitians are coming to this country, their mindset is like, oh, well, that's why these people aren't going anywhere. And I have to do my best to like not behave like them so I can have opportunities, because that's what their problem is. And it's like, you know, for me, I've had to learn like, no, this is not the reason why we're here. And I've had to help with like educating my family members about that. But again, because of this form of racism, that's the perception that a lot of people get when they think about African Americans. So I do understand that I just hit you guys with a lot of definitions about racism and the different kinds of racism. But like I do say all the time on this podcast, I do think it's important before we even talk about something for me to just explain and define what do we mean when we say racist, right? What do we mean when we talk about racism? Because until we really understand what that means, we can't really have a nuanced conversation about that, right? And so I do think the last thing that is important to talk about this is this idea of being anti-racist, but I will get there in a minute, okay? So again, when we look back to this quote, racism isn't a touchy subject if you're not a racist, I do think it doesn't really give a lot of opportunity for nuance, because I know for me, for example, I wouldn't consider myself a racist, but at the same time, racism can sometimes feel like a touchy subject, because I do still recognize that maybe having that conversation with a coworker or a friend of mine or something might mean that I might not have that friend anymore, or work might become an awkward space to sit in. But I think what this post might be trying to allude to, from how I received it, I guess, is that, you know, if you are not a racist, or you're trying not to be racist, or you're trying to be anti-racist, the topic of racism will not be touchy to you, because you'll recognize that you talking about race, you having these uncomfortable conversations around race, is a life or death type of situation. It's something that really has to happen if you want to have a better society, right? And so I think what we really have to be willing to do when we think about talking about racism is not look at it as like it's either you're being not racist or racist, because I think the reality is white supremacy and the way that things are in this country, we all have this ingrained sense of racism, this ingrained sense of anti-blackness, colorism, colonialism. Like, there's so much of this that is just embedded in us because of our society, that it's just like second nature, right? We have to kind of think about, you know, this work and the stuff that we have to do in terms of being racist or anti-racist, right? And when I'm saying that you're being anti-racist, that means that you're making a conscious decision to work towards dismantling the things of racism, right? You're making a conscious decision to just kind of reflect on what areas in your life are you contributing to racism, and how can you make adjustments, right? And so I think when you think about anti-racism and you think about it in that way, that's where I could sit and look at this quote and I'd be like, yeah, like, racism isn't going to be a touchy subject in a sense if I am actively working to be anti-racist, right? Because if I want to consciously make decisions to be anti-racist, when I see things that are racist, I'm not going to be afraid to say something about it. If I say something that might contribute to racism, I'm not going to be afraid to be like, oh shit, I shouldn't have said that. My bad. Let me take that back. Let me fix it. If I see a structure that's steeped in racism, I'm not going to be afraid to be like, hey, let's tear this apart and let's start this over. Right. So even if you think about this whole school to prison pipeline, right, you see the structure and how it's contributing to kids being put in jail system. I'm not going to be afraid to be like, you know what? How about we gather resources together to actually add funding to these schools so that these students can have better books, better opportunities, better chance at employment, better chances of staying off the streets and actually, you know, doing something else, right? So I think when you think about it in that sense, it does make sense to be able to say that racism isn't going to be a touchy subject, because it's going to be something that you just want to go face first and be like, no, let's do something about it. Let's be active. Let's be proactive. Let's do it, right? So I think that's where, for me, when I read this thing, I was like, even though it hit me, like, I was like, yes, that's right, bitch. Like, of course, racism isn't going to be touchy if you're not a racist, right? It hit me like that. But at the same time, after a while, I was like, nah, I think this needs to maybe have a little bit of a tweak to it. It needs some nuance. It needs some understanding, right? It needs to be phrased maybe a little differently. So I don't know. I say all this to say, I do think racism will always be a touchy subject, because unfortunately, the way our world is, it's always going to cost you something to say the right thing, right? It's always going to cost you something to do the right thing. So it's going to be touchy to somebody. It's going to be divisive to somebody. You can't necessarily escape that, because unfortunately, this is just the world that we're in, right? But I think when you're really actively taking steps to be anti-racist, that shit ain't gonna bother you. You know, like, you're gonna be okay with the fact that, okay, this is gonna be a touchy subject. Yes, this is gonna bother you. Yes, you might not like what I have to say, but because this is a matter of life or death and I want things to be different, I want to challenge the status quo, I don't care, you know? And I think that's why for me, I was like, as much as I love this saying, I think there needs to be some deeper conversation around what we actually mean when we say this, right? Or what is actually intended when we say stuff like this, right? Because I do think, I mean, this post probably did its job in that it forces people to have a conversation. So for some people who read this shit, they were probably pissed as hell. There's some people that read this that were like, yeah, I completely understand. But I think with me, I read this and I'm like, I think we need to unpack some of this. I think we really need to have, again, like a nuanced conversation about this and really flesh it out a little bit more, make some adjustments, right? And so I think that's what I kind of wanted to do with this segment is just take some minutes to like flesh this out and unpack it and just maybe reframe it a little bit. And that's why I say for me, I would say that racism is a touchy subject. But I feel like you're not going to really care about it if you're doing the work to be an anti-racist, right? You're going to push through the touchy part. You're going to push through the uncomfortability. You're going to push through the awkwardness. You're going to push through the possibility of, you know, losing something and say, you know what? Again, this is a matter of life and death, and I'm going to try to do something different, right? And so that's what I encourage you guys on a little bit too with this is that, you know, talking about this stuff and exposing this stuff is going to be hard. It's going to be exhausting. There's going to be a lot of times you want to slap people because you're like, get it together. You should actually care. You should actually try. It's going to be frustrating. But again, I do think like if you really, really are doing this work for the right things and you want to really change the world and make it a better place, you will be willing to push through the touchy. You will be willing to push through the hard stuff and keep going. And of course, do this with other people. I never encourage people to do this anti-racism work by yourself. I'm very fortunate that I'm part of communities of people that they get it. They want to do this work too. And so we're able to like encourage each other. And on days where we're all like, oh, I just want to quit, like, we can just be there to, you know, gas each other up and encourage each other in this work because it's hard, you know, it's hard. Sometimes it's not even rewarding. But if you're, again, if you're doing this for the wrong reasons, you, of course, you're going to want to tap out as soon as possible. But if you're doing it for the right reasons and you have the right people with you, the world is your oyster and you can do a lot more than you realize you can do, you know. So that's what I want to leave you guys with. Again, nothing against this post. I thought this post gave a lot of things to talk about. I'm sure it gave a lot of people some shit to think about. But again, like I do want us to also be mindful when we're thinking through things like what are some of the definitions? What do we mean when we say what we mean? Because I think at the same time, I'm sure that someone reading this was probably like, damn, like... I don't even know how to respond to this in a good way, or now I'm discouraged, you know. So again, I don't know. I really did enjoy this post, like I said, because it really gave me a lot to think about. And I hope it gave you guys some things to think about too with this segment. And so with that, let's get into this book. So like I said in the beginning of this podcast, we're going to be doing this book that is entitled Without Sanctuary, Lynching Photography in America by James Allen. I don't believe I said the full title the first time around, so my bad about that. But this book is a very interesting book. I'm going to start by doing what I do in all of the episodes where I give a little bit of an intro of the book from the publisher's perspective. And then I will share a little bit about the author as far as what I could find. It doesn't seem that there's a lot on him as I was like Googling him. It was kind of hard to find anything about James Allen, so I will share a little bit from the afterword from where he's shared. And then I also wanted to take some time to also give a little bit of the bios from the authors of the essays of the book. So that was Hilton Alves, John Lewis, and Leon Litzwack. So I will share a little bit from them as well. So as far as the intro of the book or what this book is about, both the publisher and the author say, the Tuskegee Institute records the lynching of 3,436 blacks between 1882 and 1950. Many times a photographer was present to capture these events. Often the images were made into postcards and sold as souvenirs to the crowds in attendance. These images are some of photography's most brutal, surviving to this day, so that we may now look back on the terrorism unleashed on Americans, African American community, and perhaps know our history and ourselves better. The almost 100 images reproduced here are a statement to the camera's ability to make us remember what we choose to forget. So already, this is really powerful. And obviously, I know that this number, I saw 3,436 here. There was another article about this that they said it was a little bit more than that, that they were able to find. But the point is, these were the ones that they were able to find and capture. And obviously, there are probably way more that they weren't able to get pictures of, or they weren't able to, I guess, get names and whatever for, but it doesn't. But the whole point is that what they were able to gather, they were compelled to put them together into this book so we can have an idea of what went on and hopefully learn from them, right? And so, again, like I said, I did try to do some research on James Allen, but I was not able to find much on him as a person. As far as I can tell, I don't know if that was on purpose, an accident, whatever. But from his afterword in the book, he does kind of talk about the fact that he describes himself as like a picker. And so he says, "It is my living and my avocation. I search out items that some people don't want or need and then sell them to others who do." So in saying this about himself, he's just highlighting his ability to kind of gather things together and put it in a place so that something that may not be as useful to one group of people may be useful for someone else. That's kind of what I got from this, especially the fact that, you know, over time he talks about going to different stores, different places, and just being a person that just like was a collector of things. And it didn't start with pictures, but with time, as he was going to different places, buying and selling things, these pictures ended up being something that was put in his lap or put in his hands and sold to him. And I think over time, he saw this as an opportunity to collect all the pictures of these horrible acts that he can find and eventually use it as a way to share the stories of these victims. And so as hard as it is to like look at these pictures, for sure, I'm thankful that he was willing to actually sit with this shit and get the pictures together and raise some awareness. Because I know one of the things that James Cones highlights in his book, The Crosses and the Lynching Tree, is the fact that because of this man's work, the U.S. Senate eventually was compelled to apologize. I mean, it didn't turn into an anti-lynching bill, which he does talk about. But at the same time, it forced America to kind of look at itself a little bit. And obviously, there's still more looking at itself that we need to do. But I'm glad that this man has the courage, or he had the courage, to put this together, right? And then so when we talk about the writers that were incorporated in this book to kind of add a foreword, and then they have some essays before you get to the pictures that were written, the foreword was written by Congressman John Lewis, and he was basically elected to Congress from Georgia's 5th Congressional District in November 1986. For more than three decades, he has been in the vanguard of progressive social movements and the human rights struggle in the United States. In 1963, he was one of the planners and a keynote speaker at the historic March on Washington. From 1963 to 1966, Lewis was the chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, which he helped form. With writer Michael D'Orso, he authored Walking with the Wind, a memoir of the movement, in June 1998. And of course, this was a short blurb of the writer that's in the book. But I know Congressman John Lewis recently passed away, I think the last year, the year before. But obviously he was a very integral part of the social rights movement, and he's done a lot of great work. So it was cool to see that he was able to be a part of this book and add a foreword. The next person who writes an essay in here is called Hellhounds, which we'll talk about a little later. His name is Leon F. Litwack. And so Leon, from this book, they say he is the author of Trouble in Mind, Black Southerners in the Age of Jim Crow, that was published in 1998, and Been in the Storm So Long, The Aftermath of Slavery, which was published in 1979, which won the Pulitzer Prize in History and the Parkman Prize also. He is a recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship and is the Alexander F. and May T. Morrison Professor of American History at the University of California. And in 1987, he was elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He is also the co-editor of the forthcoming Harvard Guide to African American History. So very cool. He has a very interesting background. And then the last person who writes another essay in here called GWTW, his name is Hilton Owls, and he is a staff writer for The New Yorker. His first book, The Woman, was chosen by the New York Times Book Review as a notable book of the year. So obviously, I mean, we can spend all day talking about who these writers are and what they have to do with this and blah, 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 blah. But the cool thing I think about all of these people that contribute to the book is their unifying factor here is that they see a need to talk about this horrible topic of lynching and, you know, bring things to light and just make it very clear and apparent that it was a travesty that was wrong, that we need to stop trying to cover up and pretend that, you know, it didn't happen. And so I appreciate the work that they put into this book, whether it was through essays, getting the photographs together, or just adding such a powerful foreword like Congressman John Lewis did. And so at the end of the day, like I said, I'm just very thankful that these men came together, put this book together, and it's cool to see just from the jump what their backgrounds are and how their backgrounds just contributed to their need and their call to just tell the stories of these victims and make it plain that this lynching history was horrible and needed to be talked about, right? And so before I go more into the book and the topic of what the book is covering, obviously, as I always do, I will talk about what made me pick this book. And I think one of the things that really drew me to even getting this book was the fact that when I did read The Cross and the Lynching Tree and he talked about this book, I was kind of shocked, especially like I said many times before on this podcast, you know, I wasn't born in this country. So I think just hearing about lynching and hearing about how vile some people were to do this and allow it to happen, and then especially this idea around making it like a family event, I was flabbergasted, I guess, by this, right? And so when, you know, this James Cone talks about the fact that this book exists, that somebody was able to compile all these, you know, pictures from postcards and stuff into a book, I was like, I have to see this. Like, I have to, not that I didn't believe it from what I see, but I just had to see this. And again, just knowing the pride that came from the ability of people to do this, to be able to be like, hey, look, Uncle Bob, like we had a barbecue and here's a postcard. It just shocks me like how disgusting humans can be, even though at the same time we can be incredibly great in a lot of ways and very creative and life-giving and all this other stuff. But to also see the other side of it is fucking nuts. And then I think too, as a budding clinician and just somebody that is very interested in human psyche, this is very reminiscent, I guess, to me of like serial killers. Like, you know, serial killers like to have like souvenirs. And we can watch the documentaries and we're like, oh my gosh, that's gross. How could they ever think to do that? Blah, 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 blah. But then meanwhile, this is what this was. Like, these Americans were serial killers and they were taking souvenirs of these different people that they were killing through, whether it was like pictures, whether it was through taking their some of their body parts and all this different things. Like, that's some serial killer shit. So if you really sit down and think about that for a minute, there's just a lot to unpack. And not to undermine the work or to excuse the work, I should say, of what white Americans need to do, or especially white people that have family in the past here. But I can almost understand how hard it is to really sit with your family tree and think about the fact that there's some people in there that were sick as fuck to do this kind of stuff. And even to the point where, you know, for preparing this podcast, I was thinking about the fact that the blurb says that this lynching stuff happened, at least from what the pictures that they were able to get, I should say, is from 1882 to 1950, right? And so as I was thinking about those days, I was thinking about a lot of the people that we even have sitting in office right now as our governors, whether it's on the Senate or House of Representatives. There's so many of them that are like 60 plus and were around when a lot of this shit was happening. They were children when this shit was happening, right? So just to Google a few, and I tried to even get some Democrats in here because I know people will be like, oh my God, you're just trashing Republicans. No, everybody can get it, okay? But the point is, Mitch McConnell was born February 20, 1942, and he was born in Alabama. Okay, Maxine Waters, August 15, 1938, St. Louis, Missouri. Bernie Sanders, September 8th, 1941. Dianne Feinstein, June 22, 1933. Mike Pence, June 7th, 1959. Joe Manchin, don't know if I said your name wrong, sorry if I didn't, but him, August 24th, 1947. And the reason why I want to point this out is because these people, between these dates that I said, and so 1950 was the last year that they have maybe of some of these, the lynchings, at least in the way that are described in this book of these hanging and these burnings, right? Most of these people were like just born, or they were just children for a little bit, right? And then again, in these books, it talks about the fact that children and their moms and stuff were going to these things, that they would stop class and stop other things to have these people go to these events. So for me, I'm thinking, if these people were children around this time that they were going to these events, or let's say they were just born, how much of the sentiments around how you feel about Black people, how much of that has changed? How much of it did it change for these people? And not to say that these people can't be doing their anti-racism work and blah, 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 but besides a few people, I know a lot of them aren't. I mean, Mitch McConnell a few months ago was saying Americans and African Americans are two different things, which was, wow. But my point is this, if you're a child during the time of this stuff going on and your parents also have racist sentiments that they're passing on to you because they were alive when a lot of this was happening too and this was normalized for them. If we're living in a country where we're saying, no, this isn't us, no, this isn't us, and they're not taking the time to unpack the trauma of seeing somebody get burned alive in front of them, unpack the vileness in you that it takes to be able to sit with yourself after you do that and pass around these people's body parts and all that stuff as souvenirs, where are we going to be as a country? And that's why I think it is challenging when we talk about these conversations around being anti-racist and really learning to critically analyze all this stuff. It's really hard to get to where we want to be because we don't even want to take an honest look of where was I when this shit was happening? Where were my grandparents when this shit was happening? Especially for these people that I'm even mentioning that's on the Senate. And it's not just them. But like all the people that we have in power right now, for them to really sit with themselves and say, where was I? Where were my parents? Because a lot of these people are, again, born in the 30s and 40s. So their parents were alive when this shit was happening. So given the age of these people, which is like 70s and 80s, right? I even think about my grandparent would have been this age. So that means people my age have to sit down and wrestle with the fact that their grandparents may have been around when this shit was happening, or their great grandparents may have been around when this stuff is happening and supporting it and passing around these postcards. And I think that's what's hard for all of us to sit with, right? I mean, not my ass because I wasn't involved in this, but especially I would say to my white American peers, right? And so, yeah, so me having to think about that and, again, bring up these names is, I just want you guys to think about, especially, again, those people that we know that are white, not that you happen to be white, because if you're already doing this work of trying to be an anti-racist, there, to some degree, you have to be thinking about this, I hope. But for those who are white and you're comfortable with your whiteness and you're comfortable with you like white supremacy and you're not willing to stand up, I want you to really stop and really think about this shit. Because again, this is serial killer shit. This is stuff that we would, like, again, where I work, we would Baker Act you, we would put you in an inpatient facility and think you're a psychopath. So I don't know. That's something that is hard for me to like really sit with sometimes, right? And so obviously when we talk about what is this book covering, like I do with other books, short answer, lynching. But I do like that if you go to the website of this book, I think it was called withoutsanctuary.org or withoutsanctuary.gov or .com. Either way, I'll post it in the notes. But I think they do a good job there of just defining what lynching is. Because as I've mentioned before, I think it's so important before you try to cover some topic, especially something as big as lynching, it is helpful sometimes to have a understood definition of what we're talking about. So especially in the case of this book, this podcast episode, what does it mean when we say lynching? And so the website basically says that the academic definition of lynching is the killing of a person outside of the judicial system by three or more people for an alleged infraction. In order to be officially counted, the lynching had to be documented in the newspaper. There are over 3,000 documented lynchings. So that's really interesting already that the part that it had to be a killing of a person outside of the judicial system, because I have my feelings about the law enforcement part, because I do still feel like law enforcement killing you without just cause should still be considered a lynching. So I don't know there what he's at with that part, and it's a lot to unpack here. But the part about there not being a trial and these people just take it upon themselves just to kill you, it's very reminiscent of Ahmaud Arbery's case, where those three people were just like, oh, he's in the neighborhood, let me just, you know, go and kill him without just cause or no reason. And then, you know, they were doing mental gymnastics to justify that shit later. So that's very interesting. And then also the fact for this specific book that he says for it to be officially counted, it had to be documented in a newspaper. And again, the fact that newspapers and journalists and all this stuff were like actively participating in these acts, and they knew who the people were that were doing it, and it was just one of those things where it's like, eh, you know, it's just another day in the United States. Like, that's fucking nuts to me too. It's like those people should be accessories to the crime, to my opinion. But, you know, hey, here we are. So, but that definition of lynching was very important. And I think that's important for us to bring up before we talk about this book. Another thing I thought was interesting is he does define what the title Without Sanctuary means. And so he says the title was chosen because African Americans had no sanctuary or protection from white mob violence. The local law enforcement and local judicial systems would not arrest or prosecute members of the mob. This was true from the state government to the federal government. African Americans were without sanctuary. Again, that is one of the things that's really hard about this conversation of lynching, because it's like you have no way to really protect yourself. There's nobody out really to protect you. It's just like, I don't know, African Americans just had to kind of like stick together and try to defend themselves. But at the same time, it's like there was no real way to defend yourself. It was just, you're kind of up to whatever, you know, it's up to whatever these white people decide to do. And so I know that's like, I imagine being in that space back then, and I'm like, wow, that's anxiety producing, right? Because I know even to a small level for me now, I know when I was thinking about moving to Chicago, to Florida, the idea of driving through a lot of the southern states to get to Chicago, it put a lot of anxiety and fear in me. I didn't want to go drive through any sundown places. I had to think about what would happen if anything happened to my car along the way, or I needed gas somewhere, what all that planning and thinking and all that stuff. And it's what that was in 2017. And as much as I want to be like, oh, you know, it's not the same thing as that time, like there's still some racist sentiments that kind of stay in this day and time that I have to be aware of. So I can't even imagine how much worse it was for them and what they must have gone through. The anxiety of, you know, you can't look at a white person because if they're having a bad day, they might think you're talking back and try to get you. And I mean, there's stories about that in this book, The Cross and the Lynching Tree also, and some other, you know, books that have accounts of what lynching was like in, back in the day. So it's just crazy to think about that shit. And again, the fact that it's like these African Americans had no safety net. They had nobody that would protect them from this. That's wild, you know? And then the last question he kind of tries to answer on the website is, why was lynching photography taken? And so he goes on to say, when lynchings were most prevalent, at the same time, photography was becoming popular. Photography equipment was expensive. Entrepreneur photographers would take photos and sell them as souvenirs. They would put tents up to develop the photos on site and market them for days following a lynching. Most were printed on postcard-sized photo paper. These postcards were called real photo postcards. So, again, yikes, because like I said, I feel like that's some like serial killer type shit to kind of try to collect and keep souvenirs. And I know that somewhere in the book they also talk about the fact that some of these lynchings became like trading cards for people type of thing. And but I do love that, at least, you know, with part of understanding the book, the topic, the subject matter, and all that stuff, that the author or whoever created this website took the time to really help explain some of this stuff. Because again, I think until you really have to sit with and wrestle with the realities of what was going on when these lynchings were happening and all these people were like dying, and then these white people were just enjoying these times like it was like another day at a barbecue. We can't change our mindsets about racism and change the mindsets around what's going on in this country until we have to like really face it. And again, I know this is shit that's like, this is so uncomfortable, this is hard, this hurts my feelings, blah, 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 blah. But I think similarly to things like, for example, Alcoholics Anonymous, a big part of what helps people who struggle with alcohol, a big part of what helps them is being able to sit with what they've done and make amends. And so that means they have to really stop making excuses for what you did under the influence. Stop making excuses for who you were under the influence, but just own it and say, this was me. I fucked up. I'm sorry so-and-so for what I did, and ask for the forgiveness and make the steps to become a better person. And so I think it's so interesting that in those kind of spaces, we're like, yeah, of course. Like, of course you need to do that. But then with this area of racism, for some reason, white people just have such a hard time of letting go and just like cutting the bullshit and just owning, like, this is what happened. This is what my ancestors contributed to. This is what I'm continuing to contribute to and buy into. And then taking the steps that they need to move forward. And I know, again, I need to hop into this book, but one of the last things I want to say is there is this prophet in the Bible, I believe it was Nehemiah, and God calls him to go build a wall in Jerusalem and you know, fix it and blah, blah, blah. And you know, the thing that always has stood out to me about his story is before he goes and he does that, he takes the time to not only ask God forgiveness for his sins, but he asks God for forgiveness for the sins of his ancestors. And not to say that he's responsible for his ancestors, but he realizes that those decisions that they made in the past influence some of the decisions that he's probably making in the present where he's at. And I think that's something that really stuck with me, of like how important it is for us to really take stock of, you know, not only our decisions, but how the decisions of our ancestors kind of affect us, right? And it's not to say that I'm going to own and take responsibility for everything, because there's things that we may not even know how to fix. We may not really realistically be able to fix, and that's fine. But at least the best that we can to recognize that we're benefiting from some of those decisions is really important. And so I think about it even as like a Christian. I did not make some of the decisions that Christians have made that have hurt other people. But at the same time, as a Christian, I can stop and recognize like some of the sins of the Christians that came before me, I've been continuing it in my walk kind of, because I didn't know that it was a bad thing for a while until now that I'm deconstructing. I'm like, shit, like this was actually very oppressive to a bunch of people. So I need to take some time and kind of repent on behalf of them, be like, damn, that was fucked up, my bad, whatever. And I have to own, okay, I also participated and continued some of this shit. So I'm, again, you kind of are asking for forgiveness for some of the stuff in the past. And then in the present, owning, like, I'm continuing some of this stuff and I need to ask for forgiveness. And I don't know if that makes sense, but I think that's what we need to collectively be willing to do when we talk about this stuff, when we talk about racism and we talk about, you know, just all the oppressive structures that have come out of white supremacy. And again, I know it's something that, like I mentioned before, it's going to cost us and it's going to be uncomfortable. It's going to be hard. It's a lot of different things, but I think if we all work together, we can really make a difference for our society in the future. So when we talk a little bit about what stood out to me in this book, most of this is just pictures, obviously. So just seeing all the different pictures of people that were lynched and reading some of their descriptions of what happened prior to that lynching was obviously heartbreaking. Most of the pictures that he has in here were from the, you know, late 1880s and then into the early 1900s. And obviously we know that lynching was going further out. And I would even say it's still kind of happening in its own ways now. But it was jarring to see this. And again, to see people were passing these pictures out to different family members, and especially imagining like what it was like for children to watch this stuff. As a clinician, I was very like concerned, because I know it must do something to your psyche to be in a space where you're so desensitized to violence like this, especially the violence that was described from these lynchings. Like, it has to do something to your psyche. So yeah, there's that. But I think one of the stories that was interesting that Leon talks about in his part, Hellhounds. He talks about this story about, I guess, in Georgia. And there is this guy who basically, his name was Sam Host, and he worked for a planter named Alfred Cranford. And basically what happens is he ends up asking his employer for an advance in pay. Some are kind of reported that he was trying to collect wages that was already owed to him, but, and then he was also trying to ask for permission to visit like his ill mother, but the planter basically refused, and it kind of led into this really harsh exchange of words, which eventually led to, I guess, Alfred threatened Sam with a gun. He like drew his pistol, threatened to kill him. And so in self-defense, Jose flung his axe at him, and it striked him in the head, killed him instantly. And within like 2 days, newspapers like were reporting a bunch of different versions. But ultimately, they painted this guy, Sam, as a monster in human form. And they were saying that he like sneaked up on this guy, killed him, and then he pillaged the house. He tried to rape the wife, all this stuff. There's so many different versions of this man. And so basically, because of all these different versions, they ended up lynching this man. They removed parts of his body. They took it and they fought over these things as their souvenirs. One of the gross parts about this to me was the fact that one of the participants, basically, they reported like that he left for the state capitol hoping to deliver like a slice of that man's heart to the governor of Georgia. And I was just like in awe of reading that. But the crazy thing about this story for me that stood out was the fact that later on, when they actually did an investigation about what happened, this white detective ended up speaking to Crawford's wife, and she revealed that Hose did come and try to pick up his wages. And she did say that her husband and this guy did have an argument, and self-defense thing did happen and all that stuff. But after that, she says, like, this man fled the scene. He never entered the house. He never assaulted her or any of that stuff. But because these white men were so upset about what happened and they made up their own myths about what happened, they just went in and lynched this person. And obviously, I'm not saying that murder is a good thing, because in a way, I guess, Host, whatever his name is, he did, you know, commit a murder. But the fact that it was in self-defense too, which I saw this multiple times in this story, it was grounds for, obviously, for there to be a trial, you know, and all this stuff to kind of see what's going on, what's a fair sentence, blah, 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 right? And even then, given where they were in this country and the climate of this country, realistically, Sam Hose probably wasn't going to have any kind of a fair trial. But the fact that these vigilantes kind of created their own sense of justice and they did what they did, that was disgusting. And so obviously, like, stuff like that really stood out with me, because I was just like, wow, like, I can't believe, again, like, this stuff was just like a daily occurrence, like something that was normalized in this time, right? And so it was also interesting to read about just how the photographers played a role in all of this. And then they also talked a little bit about the participation of women and children. And so in this section, the writer says, the use of the camera to memorialize lynchings testified to their openness and to the self-righteousness that animated the participants. Not only did photographers capture the execution itself, but also the carnival-like atmosphere and the expectant mood of the crowd, as in the lynching of Thomas Brooks in Fayette County, Tennessee in 1915. So he says about this, hundreds of Kodaks clicked all morning at the scene of the lynching. People in automobiles and carriages came from miles around to view the corpse dangling from the end of the rope. Picture card photographers installed a portable printing plant at the bridge and reap the harvest and selling postcards showing a photograph of the lynched Negro. Women and children were there by the score. At a number of country schools, the day's routine was delayed until boys and girl pupils could get back from viewing the lynched man. And so, again, it's crazy to me to think about how psychotic this is. For not only are we going to murder somebody for nothing, like you're just wanting to murder somebody for the hell of murdering somebody, but to make this such a like widespread event where you're delaying like daily activities and closing down shops, I imagine, and you know, cutting schools early and all this stuff just so people can watch this. That's very like sadistic and weird and psychotic to me. Like, I can't even imagine wanting to have that urge or that need to do so. And the fact that that was something that was so embedded in American society for so long is so barbaric to me. And again, especially when we reflect on some of the books that I talked about in the past, about this idea of, again, America being the city on the hill, this pillar of morality and blah, 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 blah. Where was that during this? And the fact that they had to do so much mental gymnastics to justify that blacks weren't human enough and they deserve this and blah, 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 blah. It's just so, you know, just so disgusting is the best word I can have for this. Like, it leaves me speechless, you know? And it's crazy because then later on he talks about how there's a lot of people, including ministers, who would receive postcards about this shit even. And he says about this Unitarian minister in New York named John H. Holmes, like they were saying that he opened his mail one day to find a postcard depicting a crowd in Alabama posing for a photographer next to the body of a dangling black man on a rope. And I guess the significance of this was this minister was a person that wanted to condemn lynching. And so this person kind of sent them a postcard in response to that. And so he says in this card, "This is the way we do them down here. The last lynching has not been put on card yet. We'll put you on our regular mailing list. Expect one a month on average." And again, what the fuck? Like, what kind of sadistic bullshit is this, you know? But again, and that's where, to me, I have such a hard time with white discomfort now, because this is shit that was done that they were proud of. Like, they had no shame about. They were bragging about it, you know? It's like the pride that Americans have now about the Confederate flag and about the fucking statues. Like, the pride that comes from this is just astonishing to me. But to see this and to read it, it really opened my eyes to some of the realities of how sick this shit was. And again, when you see the pictures in this book that kind of confirm how sick this shit was, it's hard to be willing to be silent and to not be willing to be uncomfortable and have the conversations and push people to be more anti-racist, because these are not the actions of a moral or just society. And until we can reconcile and become more aware of this, we're not going to be able to get anywhere near that. And I think that's what a lot of us Americans, especially white Americans, are missing at the point of. I think another important note that I took away from this book as well, it was just a reminder that even though the 1890s was the mark of, you know, these lynchings being exclusive rituals from the South, of like black men and women being killed by these white people, they also did point out that there were a lot of Native Americans, Mexicans, Asians, and other demographics that were lynched as well, which I wasn't aware of. I didn't know that. So I did think it was good that they brought that into the conversation. Obviously, the point of this book is to highlight what happened in the South and with these black men and black women. But I'm always for us including others in the story and talking about, you know, how it affects other people as well, because I think we don't always recognize that white supremacy that doesn't only hurt black people, it hurts everybody, even white people. So I did appreciate, you know, just being able to learn a little bit about that too and being aware of that, so that for further research or purposes, I could always learn about how lynching affected other people groups as well. So lastly, just to talk about, you know, some of the pictures in general in terms of what stood out to me. Some of these pictures, it was, well, all of them, it was just hard to look at. But I would say some were easier because it was just pictures of the white people that were present, which I thought was really interesting that, you know, there was a time and a space where there was no shame to show up to these things and just take like a group picture. I cannot imagine being this bold, but I know I have a heart and it's hard for me to even think about killing somebody, even in self-defense. Like the idea of some of that stuff is just like, I would feel really bad about it. I don't think I'd be able to sleep. But to see how there's just crowds of people, you know, in these spaces, like watching, you just standing next to these lynched bodies with no concern, no shame, pride. It's very jarring to see. And I know for me, which is kind of jokey of me, but not so much jokey, it would be interesting for me to see white people actually have to sit here and be like, wow, is my grandma in this, or my grandfather, or my great grandparent in this? And like, because chances are, yeah, they were there, you know, taking these pictures with pride. But I know for a lot of people, that's a hard pill to swallow. I know I have a friend who has mentioned before that she knows that she has people that are from the South, and the idea of really sitting with that and possibly thinking through the fact that, you know, some of her people could be responsible or were parts of this stuff is hard for her to sit with. But again, this is what this book and what I on this podcast is inviting you guys to do, just to really sit with this stuff and just take time to just own your history and like try to work forward and be anti-racist because of the fact that you know this history, right? I know a great example of this actually for me, I saw in a conference, a social work conference that I went to. These social workers, one was black, I think. One was from, I think their background was like a Middle Eastern background. I could be wrong. But one was white. And I think the black person happened to be a woman. But it was just really interesting because the white person that was in this group, they basically, he worked together with the other two to create a book talking about race and how you can use group work to talk about racism and try to work towards being anti-racist, right? And so one of the things that he said is that he had to sit with himself and actually work through the fact that there are people in his family tree that owned slaves, that owned people as property, that treated people like property and treated them like shit. And so part of his work to create this book and to eventually be able to teach us this stuff was to, you know, sit with himself in his family history and kind of repent of it, own it, and then try to find ways to move forward. And so for me, I only met this guy for like a short minute, but I appreciated that he was willing to not only do that work, but confess that in front of a group of us. It was a mixed group, obviously, of different races and backgrounds in the room. But he was willing to openly say, like, this is part of the work that I've had to do with this. And as hard as it was for me, I did it and I'm okay. And he was okay, you know. And I'm sure it's something that every once in a while shit will come up and he probably has to reprocess it and you know, hash things out again and, you know, work through it all over again and all that stuff. But the fact that he was willing to do that and the fact that he recognized the need to do that was awesome to me. And especially being that he's a white man, I think that was also very surprising, if I'm being honest, because, you know, a lot of the times white men aren't always willing to do this work, at least as I've seen in my experiences. So it was really cool to hear him openly say in front of everybody, like, this is the work that I had to do, and this is the work that we all need to do, essentially, right? And so I guess as we're ending this podcast, the million-dollar question that I ask every week or that I mention every week is, you know, how does this book kind of challenge or provoke me to think about the world differently? And obviously, I don't know if I have an answer to this. I think I would say similar to the last book that I talked about, The Cross and the Lynching Tree. Seeing these images, reading the accounts, just continues to make this more real for me. Why it's important for us to have these hard conversations and push through the awkwardness, push through our need to be like, oh, this is a touchy subject or this is an uncomfortable subject, and like lean into it. And so I think that's kind of where I am, like where it's not really that it's challenging me to do something. I think it's more affirming me and my desire to do this work and to encourage people to continue to fight your desire to run away from this, fight your desire to wanna become defensive and make excuses for, you know, why you don't want to engage in this, and just engage, just do it. And even if it means that you're fumbling through the process, fumble, but and be honest that you're fumbling, be honest that you don't know what you're doing. But, you know, take the time that you can to continue to read, grow, learn, challenge your thinking, and ask for help even. There's nothing wrong with admitting that you don't know what you're doing and seeking the guidance of people that can help you do that. But make sure you're doing it in a way that's respectful, that honors their time. If you can, pay them for their time. And I would even say you can even do things as easy as, for example, on TikTok or Instagram and certain things. Like, there are a lot of people out there that are teaching us this shit for free, and they deserve all of our coins. I'm not saying that we should never pay them, but I know there's so much about Black history and about being an anti-racist that I've learned by following certain Black people, especially Black women, but then also other people of color, like Native Americans and Asians, you know, Latinos, Latinas, Latinx people. I've learned so much just from listening to their experiences with anti-racism work, listening to their experiences of being themselves and understanding intersectionality even between that, because some of them, not only are they Latinx, for example, but they can also be in the LGBTQ community, right? So I learned so much just from engaging with their content, even if it's stuff that I'm like, eh, I don't know how I feel about this. But it gives me stuff to really think about and wrestle with. And I love that they're willing to even invite us into that process with them. And of course, I say this engagement part with the caveat, please don't be going on these people's pages and just making them feel bad, talking shit, you know, just using it as a platform to use more hate speech just because you don't understand, or especially with some white people who are using those spaces to bring on their white fragility. I'm not asking you to do that. Please, in that sense, fight your desire to open your mouth and say something that's going to be hurtful and demeaning to the conversation and doesn't contribute to it in a good way, if that makes sense. But if you don't do that, if you're not doing that, and you really have legitimate questions and concerns and you want to learn and grow, these people's pages are a great place to start doing that. And obviously, like I do on this podcast all the time, I encourage you guys to just read, because I think oftentimes we can get so caught up in our favorite broadcasting network, for example, with the news. Not that I'm, you know, partial to like CNN or MSNBC or all that stuff, but I've seen enough of Fox News where I'm like, ooh, like, as a Black person, none of this speaks to my actual experience. It speaks to fear mongering a lot of the times. So I don't really recommend that, but I also can understand that CNN MSNBC and some of those other stations are also biased. So I'm not saying those are perfect either. But what I'm saying is, you know, when you take some time to really read and hear accounts from people, from especially a first-person account, or read from people that actually have a background in this stuff and know what the fuck they're talking about, I think it really can help you just grow as a person and understand more of the world around you. And so again, this is why I'm even doing this podcast, because I want you guys to grow outside of your comfort zone and grow outside of the little tunnel vision type stuff that you surround yourself in. Because even myself, I know I have moments where I was extremely tunnel vision, and that's why I am trying to challenge myself now to engage with, you know, LGBTQ content or engage with Latinx, Asian, like all these different contexts. And I'm slowly trying to show you how I'm doing that with this podcast, because I know a big part of my story is my Christian faith. But eventually, you're going to see that I'm going to be expanding into other faiths, other backgrounds, other things too. So again, I can help make sense of my world. And I want to teach you how to do that through this podcast again, like I've said. And so I know this is a lot to take in. I've wanted to do my best, hopefully I did, to just really honor this book and the victims of this book by just putting this stuff out there for you all so that you know that this exists. And again, just having a real conversation about this, because unfortunately, I know that in this country, we don't like to have these hard conversations. And when we do kind of have movies about it, we're so busy romanticizing the white male character that saves people. We're not really paying attention to what really happens in the background with the African Americans in the movie. And also, I'm just tired of us seeing the same slavery shit too, I'm sure, for people. But at the same time, like, you know, as much as I'm tired of seeing these movies and tired of having to keep producing these movies and these books, I know it's also important for us to be reading them. And so I do encourage you guys to do your best to do that whenever you can and take breaks, because I know a lot of this stuff is heavy, but please learn, because for God's sakes, I think I've said this in this the past episode, I do not want us to be moving forward 15, 20, 50 years from now and we're still having the same conversation about racism. I would love it for us to be at a place for our future children where we can say, oh man, remember when this happened and we actually were able to move forward and we are actually able to make some kind of reparations and we were actually able to become better people? I want us to be there. And I'm hoping, maybe, I don't know if it is going to be with millennials and the future generation, but I would love to see the boomers and other people to be participants in this and have a willingness to move forward and stuff. I don't want to have to be the person that's like, oh, maybe when they pass away, we can have a better world. I hate that thought. But I mean, if it has to be, it has to be. But I really hate that thought. I really want us all, regardless of where you are in between boomers and, you know, millennials or Gen Z, I want us all to be able to come to a place where we're like, enough is enough. Let's move forward, you know? And so with that, I wanted to end by reading this foreword that was written by Congressman John Lewis that I thought was really beautiful. He kind of writes it in the beginning of the book to give you an idea kind of what this book is about. But I think he also says some things that can really encourage us moving forward, to kind of end on somewhat of a maybe a hopeful tone maybe. And so I just wanted to share it with you and by reading it. And so what he says is, "Without Sanctuary brings to life one of the darkest and sickest periods in American history. As a young child growing up very poor in rural Alabama, I heard stories about lynchings and about the night riders coming through, intimidating and harassing black people. At the time, it all seemed nightmarish, unreal, even unbelievable. The photographs in this book make real the hideous crimes that were committed against humanity. Many people today, despite the evidence, do not want to believe that such atrocities happened in America not so very long ago. These photographs bear witness to the hangings, burnings, castrations, and torture of an American Holocaust. Despite all I witnessed during the height of the civil rights movement and all I experienced of bigotry and hate during my lifetime, these photographs shocked me. What is it in the human psyche that would drive a person to commit such acts of violence against their fellow citizens? This book cannot answer my question, but it does fill me with deep sadness and even stronger determination to keep such atrocities from happening again. It is my hope that Without Sanctuary will inspire us, the living, and as the yet unborn generations, to be more compassionate, loving, and caring. We must prevent anything like this from ever happening again. And so I know for me, I agree with his sentiments, and I really do hope that, you know, with exposure to this book and exposure to other books like this, that we can be inspired to do what we can to make the world a better place. And so with that, I thank you all for just taking some time again to listen to this podcast. I hope my conversation today on this topic of lynching and this book and what it means to be anti-racist, I hope a lot of it just really stuck with you and that it will challenge you today to take whatever steps you can to just become a better person and, you know, be a part of building a better world. And so I look forward to eventually, you know, going through another book with you all. And again, as I say every week, thank you so much for your support. Thank you so much for listening. If you can, please leave a review, leave me some comments, show me some of that love so I can continue to have this platform on iTunes especially. With that said, I will see you all next week, and please enjoy my outro. Hey there, and thank you for joining me on this week's episode of Critical Reads. To find out more about me or to consume more of my content, please feel free to visit my website, soulsessionswithneff.com, where I share a variety of things, including blog posts, resource lists, and have a regularly updated calendar for this podcast. You can also follow me on Instagram and Facebook using the handle @soulsessionswithneff. While you're at it, if you really enjoy listening to Critical Reads, I encourage you to please subscribe to this show on iTunes, Google, or Spotify, and take some time to rate us on these different platforms. Your reviews will really help the show gain some visibility and also give me some much-needed feedback on how the show is doing. I thank you in advance for your time and your support, and until next time, this has been Neff with some Critical Reads.